Welcome to Amigo Podcast 12.7. Just let it be known that we know that you listening to this podcast are the Sickos Guy meme from Twitter. I just want to state for the record that on WKTKA on Thursday, I did take the points.
I did on our podcast, too. The podcast that we're definitely going to try to pull off of every bit of the internet that we can find.
I didn't take many of the points since I predicted a 3-touchdown victory, but I took the points.
Not me. I went 33-2.
But first, let's talk about our sponsors.
Our sponsors, who are wonderful for sticking by us right now, are Underground Printing, The Bow Store, Home Assure Lending, Ann Arbor Elder Law, the Residence Inn Ann Arbor Downtown, the University of Michigan Alumni Association, Michigan Law Grad, Human Element, the Phil Klein Insurance Group, Fuego Box, and Information Entropy, who have been quite a help this weekend.
All right. yeah, you didn't take the points.
No.
Always take the points.
I imagined after watching their offensive line versus Rutgers that Michigan could at least approach the level of pressure on Rocky Lombardi that Rutgers managed to get against the same offensive line. Although not entirely the same offensive line because that awful center was gone.
Well, we should introduce ourselves. I'm Brian Cook. This is the Amigo Podcast.
I am a sandbender. I am deeply depressed about all of this.
I am Seth Fisher, and I have moved on.
Yeah, it was weird. Like, usually you get big loss, huge disappointing thing, and it, like, ruins your weekend. And I'm just kind of, I didn't even, like, drink until hours later. Like, I just hung out with the kids.
Yeah, actually, I think my biggest bummer was that it's November and I didn't have hoops to turn to immediately. Although we kind of did anyway because of, like, Friday wasn't a good hoops day. So I guess, like, I'll write about basketball and I'll feel better about this.
I got an incredible assist from my family. My brother, who's a Sparty, called me and said, "This looks worse for us, or this looks worse for you than it looks good for us."
Is that helpful? Doesn't sound helpful.
And of all the things he could have said.
Thanks.
And compared to the things that Sparties were saying to me online, because they found my 2015 article and my Twitter account and thought that the 2015 article was written yesterday. I don't know how they thought I got that up in one night and somehow put all their 2015 players on the videos. But and then my kids came in with their Halloween costumes on, and we did that the rest of the night.
Oh, I do have the actual upset of the weekend for you guys.
What?
I blocked zero people on Twitter.
What? How is that possible?
I think I've successfully, like, blocked or muted pretty much all of Sparty Twitter before now.
That's crazy.
So there wasn't much left to get into my mentions. It was a pretty clean day. It was actually probably the first football day I've gotten through without blocking somebody in years.
I tweeted something like, "Good luck with that," after they hired Mel Tucker, and people were, like, forwarding that to Old Takes Exposed. Like, the guy didn't just lose to Rutgers.
Also, that's just the worst account on freaking Twitter, so let's stop with the Old Takes Exposed stuff anyway. It's so whack.
It's just, like, yeah, Michigan football sucks. That take is not yet a freezing cold take. That take is still yet to be seen about how that's going to go.
And we know because we're down there with you, and we have a terrible team to analyze as well.
I mean, I don't think it's that bad, but Saturday was bad. Saturday was very bad.
I'm just over it. Like, that sucked. And then as soon as I was like, oh, we lost that game. Like, you were tweeting something. Did something happen in the last 40 seconds that was strange? Like, after Michigan didn't get the onside kick, I just turned it off. And then someone tweeted along.
Yeah. So Michigan
Michigan got a timeout back.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, so Michigan was actually able to stop the clock and get the ball back with a little bit of time left because...
How did they get a timeout back?
I think there was either an injury or something that the refs were... Like, it was an official timeout instead of a Michigan timeout at the end of that previous possession. So Michigan got their third timeout back.
And oh, so the broadcast just never mentioned it?
Not until Michigan State was lining up to punt the ball back to Michigan did the broadcast decide to tell us, hey, Michigan actually has a chance to win this football game.
They were lining
and that
up.
Was I when I was like, oh, maybe we'll get our absurdly lucky game that, you know, apparently, you know, each team has to have like one a decade, right?
That's crazy because I just assumed that Michigan had two timeouts and there were 37 seconds left, so it was going to be Neal's, and I turned it off.
I was caught off guard because I wasn't really looking at the screen, and then all of a sudden they were lining up to punt, and I heard the explanation. It was like, wait, why did you wait until now to tell us?
I did not realize that they punted because I thought that they converted that third and short.
I mean, to be fair to the broadcast, Michigan did run the fucking ball on first and goal.
In the other down,
under 40 seconds left
scored.
In this game.
Yeah, that was an interesting 4-minute drill.
At least they didn't bring in Haskins for that play.
Just on the touchdown.
Just
when I initially posted the recap, I did not include those points. It is if you look at the URL, you will see that memorialized. It's a different score.
Well, you Seth set this segment up as fire blank question mark, and I.
So we're not doing our normal offense, defense, special teams format. Apparently,
oh well. I mean, we could still do it.
I feel like we need to address the thing. Like that's the response that
we can address
right
it
now
in
is...
talking about each of the units.
All right. Well, we'll start with the offense, which couldn't run the ball at all, and that wasn't the biggest surprise in the world because, you know, Rutgers actually has a decent rushing game, and they couldn't move the ball very much. They had one long scramble from Vedrill, and then if you look at that defensive line, they still have some guys on it. But the sheer incompetence that Michigan displayed right from the opening drop when they're trying to run power, and they got two guys running at the same player on three straight plays, you know, that Minnesota game obviously is fool's gold, because they are apparently 40 points worse than Northwestern. But the fallback there from we got all our assignments right to like we can't ID blocks on a single power run in the first quarter. I don't even know what to do with that.
Yeah, it's weird to have your week one game in week two and your week two game in week one, because it really felt like those should have been flipped in terms of, I mean, regardless of opponent, you know, that... It's really less about that when you, like you said, when you're having two guys run at the same defender and just leaving guys coming unblocked off the edge.
I mean, they had like a couple of like little tweaks, but you know, they didn't run the quarterback at all until what, the second half, maybe, or like the second quarter, like halfway through. And they had an arc that was successful. They had a couple other plays that picked up 4 or 5 yards, which is still much better than they were averaging on the interior. But they didn't run QB pin and pull once. They didn't run a QB draw once. Like, there are a couple plays that look like draws, but I think we're just Milton bugging out because the pass protection was so bad. Like, we've had this streak of games that look like Josh Gattis is really doing very well. And this was, I don't know if it was necessarily a play-calling debacle. It was an overall debacle, but I was... pretty frustrated, especially when, you know, that play where Giles Jackson got clocked
mm-hmm.
where he converts the third down and then
he got worse than clocked. He got it a little bit lower than clocked.
Well, he got blown up, and the reason he got blown up is it's 3rd and 10, and Michigan's running a guy in the flat. So you're never going to cover a guy in a flat on 3rd and 10. So you just drop back, and so Milton has to fit it in a tiny window. Who does? And Jackson has to come up with a tough catch. And then there was another play. It was supposed to be a sort of a fake to the outside, and it ended up going inside with, I think, Corum. And it relied on the idea that Michigan would throw it into the flat and take a linebacker with him. But they hadn't done that all game. Like, all the little flat dump-offs and edge stuff that were so successful last year, I don't know if they did that once. Like, they were able to get a couple of throws on the tight end stuff in the flat, but there were immediate tackles on that. They weren't able to get outside in any meaningful way.
When they did go outside, it was on like they had a couple Henning runs. Corum, beat a guy outside, and that's the only place that Michigan was winning their one-on-one matchups, which is exactly what happened against Rutgers too. Pacheco kept on beating them on the outside. State just did not have the athletes to get to the edge and play, blitzball linebackers in the middle like they were. I was surprised that we didn't test them on the edge, especially once it was working. It'd be like Michigan State turning off their outside throws. But the other thing that really kind of scared me was Chuck Filianga kept on getting pushed into the backfield by those DTs. And, like, I understand Naquan Jones is going to push some people around, but not that bad. And I thought we had some pretty burly dudes, and that does not bode well for the rest of the season because, we're going to face some other defensive tackles as well.
Who gives a shit about the rest of the season?
Yeah, if it even happens. I mean, it's already looking like the game in 2 weeks is pretty questionable. Up in the air, I'd say, against Wisconsin. It was also, we haven't even talked about the just a boggling decision to go to the Haskins Wildcat on 2nd and 3rd and goal. When you have a quarterback who can run.
Yeah. Well, they didn't do it. I mean, they I don't think they called a flat-out quarterback run. They had those arc plays, but they didn't call QB power. They didn't do any of that stuff. They faked it, and then they threw a slant the other way, which was moderately successful. And they had I did like the Mason kind of touch pass that went the other way for a chunk.
That was
fun. That was nice, but
that was probably my favorite moment of the whole game.
Ronnie Bell,
I'm sure it was
a good block on that one too.
So, I mean, they had little bits, but they just couldn't sustain anything. And I think we found out that Milton has some severe limitations right now. So they didn't go deep for a second consecutive game, and part of that is the pass blocking, but part of it is just the fact that I don't think we've seen him really put arc on a pass. And Joel Klatt, who I had some major issues with in this game, but he did point out that everything that he throws is driven. Mm-hmm. And so that basically means that Michigan doesn't trust him to throw anything more than 20 yards downfield. And when he has done that, he's been off by like 10 or 15 yards.
Oh, God. Was it Ronnie Bell who was running free?
Yes.
Down there? And he just misses him by like 20
and
yards.
And he missed Orwin Wilson by 20 yards in the Minnesota game. And so if you have the receivers who are very fast and you're not even testing them downfield when, Michigan State is really close to the line of scrimmage, they had a number of plays where they were in clear cover zero, or they had safeties. Like that safety from 15 yards against Rutgers was not there on a number of plays because they were just tight to the line of scrimmage. And Michigan supposedly has these guys who can really go, and they didn't try once to do what Michigan State was doing to Michigan the whole game.
Yeah, and that deep safety is a guy who Michigan has beaten like a drum for the last 2 years when he was a cornerback. Yeah. So
there's, I think that if they haven't tried it yet, it's because they know he can't do it. And the first couple of hints that that's the reality have come in the last couple of games when he's just been nowhere near. So tough to. I mean, it's just tough to make a living when you can't throw the ball more than 15 yards downfield, as we found out in the Alabama game last year. It's a totally different quarterback. Giles Jackson looked good, though. He was all over the place, and he was catching balls that were difficult balls to catch, which he didn't really do against Minnesota. So there's that. That's good.
Yeah, it's 7 catches on 8 targets in this one. That is a nice rate of bringing balls in. Cannot say the same about Eric All, unfortunately. That was a rough day for him. Just multiple drops, coaches comforting him on the sidelines to the point where it seems like that may have been a recurring problem that they're trying to like talk his way through a little bit. And maybe some of the practice stuff coming out about how he has great hands was kind of encouraging.
I don't know. I mean, his rep as a recruit was just like the guy who catches everything.
That's true. But yeah, maybe he's just, you know, got a mini yips thing going on right now.
Maybe he does.
Yeah, he was pretty effective as a blocker. I think he was one of Michigan's only positive blockers on the day.
Well, I get to find out.
We are encouraged that you will.
This is just, it's one of those games where people are mad at me if I do it and mad at me if I don't do it. And I'm like, well, I guess, guess I'll do it. Do we have anything else on this side of the ball?
I mean,
Blake Corum.
I was about to say, like, Blake Corum is fast, but he also had 32 yards. It's just total. It's one of those games that's, it's just really frustrating to look at, like, who is standing out and then look at the box score and see how many times they touch the ball. Like, A.J. Henning touched it twice.
We briefly touched on this, but we didn't really explore the 5-minute drill at the end of the game. Just... What? And I mean, that goes back to, I think Milton was fairly restricted, so when they were running those slants and stuff in the cover three, he was able to fit some in, and then some others were batted, nearly intercepted. I think that kind of showed up, because if you can jam up those routes and you don't think that he's going to beat you deep, then what do you got? Well, you got checkdowns. And also the pass protection was so bad on that drive that frequently he just had to take a check down. So
I was going to say he did not have a lot of options on that drive.
But even so,
this,
like at this some point,
huge come down.
At some point, you got to push the ball downfield because,
yes.
I mean, running off 4 minutes and scoring a touchdown, it's like whoop-de-frickin'-do.
I forgot to include it in the headline initially.
Like it's... It is a, I mean, it'd be one thing if this was a one-off, but this is pretty much constant, and it's been constant since, I don't know, ever?
Well, and they called run plays during this drive.
Well, just once they got down to the goal line. So they got a first and goal from the 2, and they're like, well, why don't we run it up the middle, which hasn't worked all day. And, I mean, at that...
But maybe it'll surprise them.
I mean, at that point, there are 40 seconds left, so you're going to go onside either way. So I guess you screwed up your clock management so badly that that's a justifiable decision.
Set up the rushing touchdown on
Hell
second.
Hell yeah. Got to get those dollar bills, y'all. All right, let's take a break, come back, talk about the defense.
Get a holiday head start with Underground Printing. Whether it's a new custom swag for the staff or personalized face mask for the team, UGP can meet all of your custom apparel needs. They are locally owned and operated and have thousands of 5-star reviews. Check out UGP's holiday gift guide at ugp.io/holiday-gift-guide because custom holiday gifts are a great way to stay connected. My wife loves to make fun of me because so many of my shirts are from UGP. They're not all Michigan. I've had them custom make some. They've been supporting MGO Blog for so long that they've had time to replace my entire wardrobe. Seriously, check them out for this holiday. ugp.io/holiday-gift-guide.
Let me just tell you a couple things to keep in your mind while you're out there. When we take the field, we're going to win. We've got big goals. We've got big ideas. We've got to win this game, and there is no game on the remainder of our schedule more important than the one you're going down to the tunnel to play today. Now let's go. Let's go.
Underground Printing is proud to present the Bow Store. Visit us at our new location at 333 South Main or online at www.bow.team.
In southeastern Michigan, the yearly cost for a nursing home averages
$110,000.
It doesn't have to, though. Reed McCarthy founded Ann Arbor Elder Law after handling a tricky situation for his own family. Years of experience later, his boutique firm works with clients across southeast Michigan dealing with Medicaid planning, long-term care, and tax, disability, and family law, not to mention family dynamics. If you have a family member who may need that level of care, or if you're ready to start your own estate plan, Reed can give you a plan for the future. Visit AnnArborElderLaw.com or call 734-945-9693. That's 734-945-9693.
Are you planning a business trip, a Michigan reunion, or a revenge tour in Ann Arbor and don't want to be stuck out by I-94? Look no further than the Residence Inn Ann Arbor downtown. Positioned at the corner of Huron and Ashley, the hotel is just a block from Main Street and a short walk to Michigan Stadium and Central Campus with all the amenities you expect. Also, we podcast here most Sunday mornings, so if you let us know you're coming, we'll let you put a shout-out on the pod. That's the Residence Inn Ann Arbor downtown.
Sometimes I wonder why I spend the lonely nights dreaming of a song, the melody haunts my reverie, and I am once again with you. When our love was new, and each kiss an inspiration.
All right, so Michigan has not recruited a corner who can run since Ambry Thomas. That's, I mean, Jamon Green actually, maybe will lead.
He's athletic. He's just doesn't have, his ball skills have not developed.
Honestly, I thought that the one that he gave up wasn't that bad. That was a perfectly paced ball. He was a little bit out of phase. He had a hand up. He mm-hmm. was, you know, that might be push coverage to me. Like, I haven't made a decision on it yet, but it wasn't like, oh, everything else was. Especially Vincent Gray, who
got benched.
A little late he got benched. I mean, late. There's a crucial, I mean, I know it was pretty early in the game, it was still 7-7 at this point, but like there's a crucial third and long, and they're bringing in a blitz. I just posted a picture of it on Twitter today, and they've got Gray down in press coverage, and Michigan State runs some motion beforehand just to confirm what everyone knows, that Michigan's in their cover one, and Gray is one-on-one with Jalen Naylor, who is not a great route runner, who is not a particularly great pass catcher, but has speed. How, if you've seen Vincent Gray, are you watching the same Vincent Gray? Like, is there somebody else in practice who's putting on his jersey and, like, going out there and doing things that, you know, they flip you on somebody? I have no idea what's going on that they would think that Vincent Gray could make that play. And what does he do? He's a flagrant hold. You know, there's multiple flags that come out of it. Michigan fans are mad just because of the flags that preceded it, but that play is 100% of the time,
none of those
called, and he had to do it.
None of those
beat.
Flags were bad calls. There was a terrible no call on Michigan on that third down where Saint Russell was just getting mugged, but none of the defensive holding or pass interference calls was bad. Like, you might be able to argue that one of them was uncatchable, but what Vincent Gray did on that is he grabbed the guy's arm and yanked him off his route, and like. The ball was probably uncatchable, but it wasn't so uncatchable that's not going to get called. Like, it was vaguely in the guy's area, and that's enough for the catchable status.
It didn't matter if it was uncatchable because it was called defensive
holding. No,
that one
was a PI.
Because he was defensive holding.
We're thinking about different plays. Okay. And the thing is, like, if you watch Vincent Gray last year, in his 200 or so snaps, like, it kind of looked like this was coming. I mean, the preview that I posted was very skeptical of Vincent Gray, and mostly banked on the idea that he was a redshirt freshman last year and he would improve a great deal. But he still can't run. And Michigan is a press man defense with corners who can't run. And you can play him in off coverage, but they don't know how to play off coverage. You can play him in zone, but they don't know how to play zone. So you have guys who have spent all their time drilling press man who can't play it. And you know what this reminds me of? It reminds me of Blake Countess. You know, Blake Countess is a junior at Michigan, sophomore, whatever.
he got a redshirt
junior at Michigan. Michigan is more of a zone system. He's extremely crafty, has a bunch of picks, looks like a great player. Michigan goes to man, and then we remember that game where Notre Dame put Will Fuller on him, or Michigan put Blake Countess on Will Fuller, and that guy wasn't even in the zip code, and that happened in this game. So you have Vincent Gray, who doesn't even bite on a double move from a Michigan State wide receiver and still loses so badly he gets beat over the top. Can't run. And Michigan hasn't recruited a corner who can run, and I think that's kind of a problem.
Yeah. They thought that D.J. Turner could. We haven't seen that guy.
I mean, like, all of these recruiting profiles I am doing, everybody's like, this guy's a good corner, but he can't run. Jalen Perry can't run. D.J. Turner can't run. Darian Green Warren can't run. None of these guys can run. So what do you do?
Eamon Dennis?
Hopefully they don't have
anywhere to go, man.
Play some freaking zone.
But you're not a zone defense. Like, they suck at zone. They suck at off coverage. So you're fucked. That's what this defense is. It's fucked.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I disagree there. I think they got to try something different than pressing up on guys and letting them just run.
Yeah, that's not going to work. But I agree. It's not going to work, but I agree.
I mean, Daxton Hill is your only answer. Put Daxton Hill at corner and find another safety. I mean,
they've already been using Daxton Hill to lock down one receiver, and that's the problem. He can only guard one guy.
I think Jamon Green is fine. I think that they can survive with Jamon Green and Daxton Hill and get through the season.
The issue there is that, like, Jaden Reed didn't have a catch in this game, I think.
He had one, but it was like late.
What happens if you have Makari Page on Jaden Reed? Like, right. we saw what happens when Michigan goes to their third safety against a quality slot receiver. So it's robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Yeah, Ricky White had 8 catches on 10 targets for 196 yards.
This guy can't run a route.
I don't know what else to say.
The only route he ran were fly routes. The only thing he did was run down the sideline, which you can teach any freshman to do.
There was one
double
move that was not well run that still annihilated Gray.
But I mean, that's like everybody out there can just go on their track team, grab a guy, and put him at wide receiver. And as long as he can catch the ball, then he'll have, you know, a 100-yard game. And if he can't catch the ball, he'll have a 60-yard game because we'll commit PI on him.
Well, do you want to talk about the other incredibly disappointing thing?
I think we have to.
Michigan's defensive ends were non-entities in this game. They looked amazing against Minnesota. Mm-hmm. They couldn't be blocked. And in this game, I don't know if they got a single pressure. Maybe there were one and two sprinkled in there, but like,
Pay had a couple hurries, but the ball was, I think a lot of it was just the ball was getting out so dang fast because, even on these deep balls, other than the two double moves that they ran, these were balls that were getting out early that Lombardi was just throwing with touch 40 yards downfield because he knew that his guys were going to be there.
I mean, I think there's something, you're right, that for a large portion of the game, Michigan State avoided dropbacks that took any amount of time. But I think in the second half, like, there were a couple of drives where I'm just like, when is anyone going to approach this guy? And he's sitting in the pocket for extended periods. So, you know, I think that is a part of what Michigan State tried to do. But then I think they got halfway through the game and they were like, these guys aren't getting to us. And there were a lot of, like, holding complaints on Twitter. I didn't see anything that I thought was clear.
Nah.
Yeah.
The other thing I noticed that may explain some of it was it did seem like they were having to take on so much run responsibility, kind of like how things went last year, where they were having to pinch inside a lot. I mean, because Michigan's tackles were not holding their ground particularly well, and they had so much run responsibility that I think that hurt the pass rush deeper in the game than you would have liked, especially since, you know, once you get into the second half, then Michigan State you know, is in a position to start burning clock, and you can't let that happen.
Yeah, that was exactly what I saw too, was that Quiddy especially was trying to dive into B gaps and then bull rush his way to the quarterback. Like, they did not have opportunities that much to, like, just tee off. Like, Michigan State puts their defensive ends wide, and then they come in on an angle. And that is going to make sure you get to the quarterback within 2.5 seconds. Now, State gets the ball out in under 2 seconds, almost every play. And Ace is right about that. But on the times they didn't, they often caught Michigan diving inside with their defensive ends, where, you know, Michigan's defensive ends were just using their strength to push the guys back instead of, you know, swim moves or setting guys up.
They also seem to catch Michigan's blitzes with screens, like, every time that they sent extra men. I don't know what you do about that.
Like, the 14 or 15 where Michigan sends the house, and I'm just like, are you kidding me? Like, if there is a single football play which is, like, drop seven guys in a zone, it's second and goal from the 14.
It was bad.
Well, and then the other thing that I think contributed to the defensive tackles, defensive ends being inside a lot, is Michigan ran a 3-3-5 for half this game, maybe more than half this game, and they'd make a crazy line shift, and Michigan State would be like, well, let's run at the big gap with Ben Van Sumeren and nose tackle Quiddy Pay, and they ripped off a 28-yard run on that. There was a particular run where it was just like, well, they're just going to run directly at this, and it was 6 yards. It's not a run defense. How many years is Don Brown going to have this 3-3-5 out there, see it gashed every time? Minnesota picked up 6 yards of play when they ran inside on it. That was 6 plays, 6 yards of play. It's at this point, I don't know how you can possibly justify running that out there on anything other than a passing down.
If you can run a 3-3-5, it works. Like, that 20-yard gash, they have linebackers out of their lanes, and, like, if that's what you do all the time, 3-3-5 defenses work because they show up in surprising places. And that play specifically had Van Sumeren take it 2 gaps over from where he was lining up. And it would have worked if they had the linebackers in position. But to your point, you have to run it all the time to know where your gaps are going to be, because things get a little weird. As soon as they pull somebody, as soon as somebody folds or anything that happens, your linebackers are going to have hard reads. And if you run it all the time, you're going to make those reads, be in position, and you can play it. 3-3-5 itself is not the problem. If it's not your base, if you don't know what you're doing, if you're not practicing that all the time, it's like zone defense. You're going to screw it up more often than you're going to get surprises.
Well, it's just, I mean, we've seen it for years now, and whenever it shows up on a standard down, it just gets gashed. And why would it be different now? Like, at what point do you stop being so stubborn and be like, all right, our defensive tackles are vaguely functional. More importantly, having two defensive tackles in there allows our defensive ends to act more like defensive ends, which they are great at. But Quiddy Pay is not a nose tackle. Like, I don't know how to say it more clearly. Quiddy Pay is not a nose tackle. Stop playing him at nose tackle. All right. Well, let's. Do we have anything else here?
Jordan Shipley was surprisingly okay.
Well, that's another thing. Is that Adam?
Adam Shipley. I got his name wrong, so that helps.
Yeah, he was. He was all right. So that's good. We got. We've run off all of our scholarship linebackers, but the walk-on was functional. Like, it's a dysfunctional program when you literally have no backup linebackers because 4 of them transferred. Like, you just can't have that, but we have that all the time. They didn't recruit a cornerback who can run. They're a press man system. And every time you go into a recruiting profile, it's like, this guy runs a 4.7. This guy's a really good cornerback, except he can't run.
Mike Dwumfor is 1-0 against Michigan State this season.
Okay. Yeah, well, you know, at least there's that. Start being Mike Dwumfor fans. All right, we're going to take a break, come back, and talk basketball.
This is Matt Demarest, the owner of Homesure Lending. We're a local mortgage company here to help you purchase with confidence and refinance with ease. People don't get mortgages very often, so it can be confusing. We'll break down every single line item so that it all makes sense. And at the end of the day, if we're not giving you the best deal, we'll tell you to go with the other company. We're here to offer our simple mortgage guidance.
This is Seth Fisher from MGO Blog. Over the years, we've sent dozens of readers to use Homesure Lending, and every review that's come back has been raving. I myself used them to refinance after doing our original loan through our bank. I was amazed how much smoother the process was for our company. complicated loan. Brian used them. You should use them too.
Finding out whether it makes sense or not to refinance or getting pre-approved to buy a new home is easy. Head over to homesurelending.com. That's HOMESURE lending.com/mgoblog to find out more. Or call us at 734-531-9950. That's 734-531-9950. I've got two of my favorite people here with me. Kind of an annual tradition. Cooper and Colby. Cooper, how old are you?
11.
Colby, how about you?
9.
Can I get a Go Blue?
Go Blue!
NMLS number 1161358, Equal Housing Lender.
Win or lose this season, stop into Information Entropy and make sure that you have a good time on game day. First-time customers can light up a free pre-roll and enjoy the quality cannabis products that this shop has to offer. Located 2 miles away from the Big House and accessible to ages 21+, find Information Entropy at 1115 Broadway, across from the Kellogg Eye Center off Plymouth Road. They don't want to hear the words go green over there, but they are happy to help you smoke it. Check them out at Information Entropy.
Hey, so I have like insurance and stuff, but I don't really like know what's going on with it.
Yeah, your coverage probably sucks, and you're paying way too much for it. And I know this because I had a guy, his name's Phil Klein. He's actually a Michigan alum and wrestled for Michigan. He okay. looked at my insurance, and he was like, yeah, your coverage sucks, and you're paying a lot more than you need to for it.
I also, like, I hesitate to even mention this, but I do have my insurance from a company that advertises during college football games. Well, and I wish that was not the case.
Well, why don't you just get it from a cool guy who actually, like, reads MGo Blog?
Well, how would I do that? They have a website?
They have one of those, too. It's philklineinsurance.com. Can you remember the name Phil Klein?
Sure.
Can you remember insurance?
Yes.
Okay. Use those two together, and you will save money on your insurance, and you will actually get better coverage on your home and your auto, and they do life, too.
All right. So you're telling me if I Google Phil Klein Insurance, this website will come up?
Yes.
Wonders never cease.
This has really evolved from, like, angry sports radio guy to Wicked Witch as she's melting.
Yeah, that one was a little falsetto, but that's okay. Got to mix it up sometimes.
People also don't get to see the fact that he did not melt, so they might kind of wonder if...
I do have to...
Anyway, my hot take is nobody deserves to be fired right now!
I love that your nobody deserves to be fired hot take needs like a right now. Like the hot take is no one needs to be taken out on a tarmac and shot.
Well,
we're not kippening anybody yet.
Dude, this is certainly a minority view right now. Also, you know, as to the right now part, Harbaugh's contract's up at the end of the season, and there's no need to like play the game of like we need to re-up him right now because hey, you know, there's a big COVID thing. We've got a $40 million deficit, so no one's going to be signing
hey,
away
Seth, I got $25 million a year. For you. Harbaugh's never getting fired.
No, And it should not be. I don't think that this is a Harbaugh system is over and we can do better. I don't think that there's anyone out there that Michigan can do better with.
I agree with that. There's nobody out there who's clearly better. But I don't agree with that Harbaugh isn't over. I feel it's over. It just feels like it's over. Like, I don't know.
How many times do we need to take it in the face before we say
my operative theory here is if I go into full-on panic nihilism, that things will improve for the team. So there it is. Panic nihilism. It's over. Everything is over. Michigan football is Iowa. That's my take. That's not even my hot take.
No.
Take that will hopefully
it's
relieve
really only
this
hot
curse.
Because Iowa is not Iowa right now.
Ace, I need your hottest take.
Oh, that was brutal.
Juwan Howard is bringing home a national title within 5 years.
Whoa. No, that is not full on panic nihilism.
No, but it's about a different sport. And it's especially sunny, actually, because who knows if we're even having an NCAA tournament this year, so I might be giving him less time than it even seems. But currently has the number one 2021 recruiting class, brought in a pretty nice 2020 class, seems to be continuing some momentum, hopefully holds on to the five-star who is currently breaking the five-star wing curse. There's a lot to like about the direction he's taken the program, and the only thing that kind of holds me back from full-on predicting the national title thing is that the NCAA tournament is a bit of a random number generator at some point.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that is a pretty hot take for that reason alone.
That's why it's in this section. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you get a national caliber team, you still have like a, you know, maybe a 1 in 5 chance of bringing it home.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've learned this all too many times.
Just the once, really. The second time was not like, I mean, that was just
that was more
Red
the
Sea
parting. This is really a random number generator tournament experience. But yeah.
My hot take is Paul Fancy is a golden god.
That's not even hot. That is the coldest take I've heard in a while.
If you don't remember this, we kind of everybody on Michigan Twitter and every Michigan podcast was pointing at this guy live tweeting a fictional Michigan State game. Over, like, he had like 60 tweets about this, and at the end of it, Michigan State won by 3 points. So.
It turns out he's a prophet.
So,
thanks to hashtag fourth quarter grit.
Nate Silver, hire this man today. It's got to be today. So I just thought that it was only fair to eat crow on our Paul Fanson trash talk.
Mea culpa.
Mea culpa.
I think that fourth quarter grit t-shirt should be in our store. I mean, he was so correct that he deserves to, like, you know.
We're going to put
something.
A Paul Fanson t-shirt in our store?
No, we're not.
Well, I don't think we're going to do it because we are capitalists.
Not even Paul Fanson is going to purchase that t-shirt. Maybe his mom.
I'm just saying he deserves it. I'm just saying we're doing him a disservice by not doing
so. Okay, well.
If we make it a white lab coat.
Anyway, if you'd like us to continue doing this extremely humiliating segment, go to fuegobox.com/mgoblog. They'll send you 3 hot sauces a month focused on flavor, not merely heat, and you'll get $10 off your first order.
Resist the temptation to dump the hot sauce into your eyeballs.
Anyway, now we move on to a cheerier topic because no games have been played. The basketball team got some important news a couple days ago when Shaundi Brown got his transfer waiver. You know, not something that I think was much in question because everybody's getting a transfer waiver.
That's true.
But if there was ever a team that was going to get an important player shot down, it was going to be Michigan.
Especially this weekend, apparently.
Yeah.
But avoided that little punch. The addition of Brown really opens up. It's important as much for what he brings to the table as it is just his versatility. And the line of versatility that he brings to the team. Now you've got potentially Brown, Franz Wagner, and Isaiah Livers all in the starting lineup if you want them. You've got Brandon Johns there too. I mean, it opens up more small ball lineups or the possibility of playing small ball for a longer period of time. Maybe even potentially pushes Brandon Johns to spending more time at the five than the four, if that's what gets Michigan's most talented players out on the floor at the same time. I mean, it was expected, but it's also pretty huge for the success of the team this year.
Yeah, and just in terms of, you know, last year, Michigan was a very, very good basketball team when Isaiah Livers was available. And then when he was out, they just didn't have the depth to keep up with Big Ten teams. And this, I think, helps prevent a recurrence of that. So last year they had, seven rotation players who were functional. And this year you have Davis, you have Smith, you have Brooks, you have Livers, that's four. You have Browns, Johns, Wagner, Hunter Dickinson. So that's, and then if you can get anything from like Zeb or Terrence Williams or Jace Howard, like I think you're going to be a little bit deeper.
Yeah, I mean, this solves a lot in terms of depth, pending any COVID uncertainty, but we haven't heard anything like that yet. We also don't know when the season starts, so who knows? This helps shore up pretty much every position across the board in one way or another, because you now can maybe keep Eli Brooks and Mike Smith's minutes pretty much limited to the point guard position, and have the wings pretty much take over the two guard spot.
Yeah, and I think we're all hoping that Wagner develops enough pick and roll ability to be kind of that secondary playmaker.
Yeah, because Brown is more of he's kind of a garbage man on offense for a two guard. He's listed as a guard on the roster, at least. He's a burly dude, but he's 6'5".
He reminds me of Glenn Robinson at Michigan.
Yeah, like not a sniper, but a guy who's got a reasonable enough jumper where you can't just leave him alone, and then somebody who's going to make some physical drives every once in a while that are mostly off the catch, and otherwise kind of pick up buckets here and there off of cuts and putbacks and kind of doing little. I think Jason Tate, without some of the weird point forward stuff, could also be a comparison. Maybe a little bit better of a shot than Tate had. Tate was kind of a strange offensive player.
Do we have a problem at point guard and center now? Like I Austin Davis is Austin Davis, but I don't know if he's going to become a great defensive center. And you know, we're throwing out a true freshman in Hunter Dickinson. Like, can we like ameliorate that with like some Livers minutes or what?
Well, I assume Brandon Johns is going to play a lot of minutes at center. I mean, we already saw the beginning of that last year. You do also have Livers available. He has played some small ball center minutes in the past. I don't think those went particularly great. You know, maybe he's, 2 years later, 2 years bulkier, maybe he's able to pull that off a little bit better. But I kind of prefer to see Johns as that guy. But this does, I mean, Davis gives you a floor and a ceiling. Dickinson has a higher ceiling but a lower floor as a freshman. I think Johns gives you, at least in terms of what he unlocks, in terms of the full lineup and being able to go five out, probably the most interesting high upside lineup. And now they have a lot more room to play that.
And are they limited at point guard too? Because I mean, Eli Brooks and Mike Smith are both seem to be like low ceiling kind of guys.
Well, I mean, Smith is a high ceiling guy as long as you can get him shots where he can catch and shoot. So like he's a point guard, but if Michigan is running their offense through him like all the time, I think that's going to hamper his efficiency. Like he's a guy who, if you can have a secondary ball handler like a Wagner draw and you can kick to him, then that's going to be, I think, a very positive development for Michigan. But
yeah, I think we're once again going to see a pretty egalitarian approach to handing out assists, because you've got a number of guys who can sort of take guys off the dribble, but you don't necessarily have like a standout pick and roll dude yet, unless Wagner really breaks through, or livers suddenly develops a handle, which I'm not necessarily expecting. But I mean, and Smith's interesting as a guy who can potentially add a little pop off the screen. But you, like Brian said, you more want him as a dude who's gonna catch and fire. But I think they can run a system where you're not necessarily relying on having a guy create a ton in the way a traditional point guard would.
Yeah, and just to go back to Shaundi Brown, I was looking up his synergy profile. Spot up is 99 possessions. That's 35% of his shots. Transition, 18%. Cut, 15%. Offensive rebounds, 9%. ISO, 5%. Post, 5%. Pick and roll ball handler, 4%. So that kind of paints a picture of what he's going to be on offense, right? He's a guy who's going to absorb shots. He's not going to create shots. He's going to chip in on the offensive boards. He's going to be, you know, an okay shooter. Like, he's 61st percentile, the spot-up guy, so, like, decent, but he's not going to blow the doors off there. And then he's going to be a good defender, good rebounder on defense. So he's not a guy who's going to be the star of the team, but he's going to be a solid, productive college player.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned the defense because, I mean, just by adding this level of size and experience, I mean, that's another thing going in Michigan's favor for them having a really strong defense next year, especially if they can get Dickinson going as a drop coverage center at 7'2", or just be able to be super switchable with Johns out there. And Brown adds switchability as well as size, and this is going to be a defense that is just going to be pretty difficult to match up against across the board, I think, for a lot of opponents that aren't going to be able to have that position-by-position length, burliness, and experience combination.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I'm afraid of is that Mike Smith gets matched on, like, a 6'4 point guard, and they don't have anybody small enough for him to switch on to. Like, he seems like a pretty limited guy just from his size. I mean,
that is getting concerned about, like, maybe one or two opponents on the schedule.
Well, I mean, it's
like it's college basketball. There's always a guy to hide somebody on, and also you play more zone these days. And Michigan has a team where zone seems quite viable. If you've got Dickinson in at center, good luck driving at that guy. They're, you know, and also if Smith's a problem on defense, then we've seen how good Eli Brooks is as a defender. Just put him in there.
Yeah, Michigan does have matchup options, so you're probably going to be giving something away if Brooks is your point guard on offense. But if you've got a tough matchup defensively, I mean, you can always pick, right? And it's not going to be ideal. Mm-hmm. Like, Michigan's always probably going to be giving something up, but at least you're not going to get absolutely roasted by a point guard.
Yeah, and rarely do you have a perfectly constructed college lineup. It's more about, can you patch those holes? And Michigan now has the options to patch some holes if they run into trouble with guys in certain matchups.
So with Shaundi in the fold, yeah. What's our projection? Like, we obviously have to be very vague because of COVID and everything, but like, approximately where would they finish in the Big Ten? Approximately what NCAA seed would they get?
Yeah, it's so hard to project. Bart Torvik's 2011 projection or 2021 projections with Shaundi Brown now being counted in the lineup has Michigan as the number 11 team in the country.
Wow.
That'd be real nice. And that'd be only behind Wisconsin in the Big Ten and three spots ahead of Michigan State.
That's where does he get
that?
That
seems
from?
A little optimistic. I don't.
That's crazy.
No,
because like usually a lot of that is who's returning and what efficiency did they have. And you know, Michigan gets back Brooks, Wagner, and Livers, but they lose Teske, they lose Simpson. Like, I mean, they lost Castleton, they lost Julius, they lost a lot of minutes from last year's roster. And the recruiting, you know, you expect. I think you're probably getting a bump from Hunter Dickinson, but the recruiting class this year isn't like knock your socks off Kentucky. This is going to be a national contender. That's way higher than I expected them to be.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd quite put them in the, like, missing the Sweet 16 would be a disappointment bucket quite yet. There's some questions to answer first. I do like I keep going back to the line of flexibility, but I think with Juwan Howard's on-court coaching acumen that makes a real difference, that he I would think he's going to be better than a lot of college coaches at getting the most out of a roster in a lot of ways, especially now that he's getting to shape the roster a little bit. So I certainly see them as a team that, you know, has a decent chance of making the second weekend of the NCAA tournament. Probably has, you know, at least a 50-50 shot of being a top four seed in the conference this year, especially with the amount of talent that has gone out. And there is some, you know, potential Big Ten championship upside depending on how things shake out. But, you know, some pieces would definitely have to fall into place for that to happen.
Yeah. So, I mean, this kind of feels like, you know, a ramp-up season. Because last year, you know, you have Simpson around, you have Teske around. It's still a John Beilein roster. And you have, they were going to be a sixth seed per KenPom last year. So they have a decent year despite losing Livers for big chunks of it. They look like they're okay. And then this year, it's kind of a year to tread water. And then hopefully next year, you get the second big recruiting class. You have your center recruit becomes a sophomore, which is going to be a big leap for him. And then that's where I think you're going to start seeing the uptick back to, this is a top 10 team.
Yeah, and you get like Zeb Jackson. He'll probably be viable next year. I don't know how much he's going to
get. I mean, nobody really has any idea.
Terrence Williams, another guy. Like, yeah, like you're going to get this year's recruits, I think, are more for next year's team than guys who are going to really going to make a big difference this time. I mean, Hunter Dickinson has to, just because of the depth at center, but everybody else seems like, you know, if they come through, great, but I think that we're really looking at them for next year.
Yeah, these guys are like poke your nose through in year one, and then hopefully you get one or two of them emerging as sophomores. And
we'll also see how the free year of eligibility impacts next year too. I have no idea how to figure out projecting rosters for any year now in any sport, but
well, Michigan only has the two. They have Davis and they have Brown now. I guess Mike Smith too. That's weird.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He could
Big Country forever.
6 years of Austin Davis.
Actually, you know what? CJ Baird can be on the team another year too.
I don't know if that's gonna affect the rotation, Seth.
I don't care. We still have the CJ Baird, like, that's been a fan thing for how many years now?
Yeah.
Like we thought it was going to be, he's been playing since he was a true freshman, I think, and then he took a red shirt in between. So, like, we've had that, like, CJ Baird, get him a three at the end of the game thing for so long now. It's amazing that we actually might continue another 2 years.
I think being a human victory cigar wears off at some point.
No.
The thrill of it?
No.
For the subject, not for the rest of us.
Well, hopefully he's got one more year of being a human victory. I mean, he's probably going to like have a master's degree and want to go somewhere to do a job type of activity.
I think he'll probably want to start his life instead of just hanging around forever.
He was going to come on our podcast, and then he got
another year of eligibility, so he had to not do it.
That's right.
Fair enough. All right, we're going to take a break, come back, and talk to Jamie.
Let me just tell you a couple things to keep in your mind while you're out there. When we take the field, we're going to win. We've got big goals. We've got big ideas. We've got to win this game, and there is no game on the remainder of our schedule more important than the one you're going down to the tunnel to play today. Now let's go! Let's go!
Underground Printing is proud to present the Bow Store. Visit us at our new location at 333 South Main or online at www.bow.team. Yeah!
During these challenging times, it is important to have a Michigan man in your corner. If you or someone in your life has questions, concerns, or just want to discuss your legal rights, give attorney Jonathan Paul a call at 248-924-9458 or visit his website, michiganlawgrad.com. John asks you all to be safe. We're going to get through this together. And as always, go blue.
Passion for e-commerce.
Sell stuff online.
Security. Performance.
Conversion.
Beautiful user experiences.
Belle expérience utilisateur.
Monthly marketing.
PPC SEO.
Make your user a customer.
Conversion.
Eau de Parfum for online retailers. Love your website. Let human elements show you how.
Available at human-element.com and find department stores, not find department stores.
Get a holiday head start with Underground Printing. Whether it's a new custom swag for the staff or personalized face mask for the team, UGP can meet all of your custom apparel needs. They are locally owned and operated and have thousands of five-star reviews. Check out UGP's holiday gift guide at ugp.io/holiday gift guide because custom holiday gifts are a great way to stay connected. My wife loves to make fun of me because so many of my shirts are from UGP. They're not all Michigan. I've had them custom make some. They've been supporting MGO Blog for so long that they've had time to replace my entire wardrobe. Seriously, check them out for this holiday. ugp.io/holiday gift guide.
Welcome in, Jamie Mack at JustCoverBlog.com. How you doing, Jamie?
I'm doing well, guys. It's going to take a while to get over yesterday's Michigan State game, but that's why they invented bourbon, among other things.
All right, number 9, Wisconsin at Nebraska, canceled.
Wisconsin wins canceled anyway.
You know, I don't know if you know, but they actually showed two of the blowout Wisconsin wins over Nebraska during BTN yesterday in the afternoon. So Wisconsin wins by then, right? One of them was that 70-20 Big Ten championship game. So, you know, I think if the people think the Big Ten has it out for Nebraska, I think the BTN replays yesterday during the college football day speaks to that a little bit.
Let's start with the most insane game of the week. That would be Maryland 45, Minnesota 44 in overtime. Minnesota misses an overtime extra point. They pull the 2000 Orange Bowl. But, I mean, the takeaways from this is, holy God, Minnesota's defense must be abominable. Maryland scores 3 points on Northwestern. Jake Funk rushes for 216 against Maryland. Tua Tagovailoa passes for 394. Maryland almost gets to 700 yards of offense.
675 yards.
Yep.
And then, of course, Michigan. Michigan plays Minnesota. They're like, oh, we must be pretty good. No, sir.
And this had to happen on Friday night, too. So, like, we had the little, like, we had to go to bed after a week of ripping on State and being like, uh-oh.
We didn't listen.
Yeah. Maryland outgained Minnesota by 224 yards, and they ran only one more offensive play.
Gracious.
And, right? Totally. And through two games, they are dead last in the Big Ten in yards per play allowed at 9.5. That's 2.3 yards worse than the next worst team, Nebraska, in the Big Ten, who actually played Ohio State. So that's pretty bad. You know, it's been talked about already, so this is a little redundant, but they lost a lot of key senior defensive players last year, including Winfield, who was an underclassman, and they just don't have the defensive roster, I guess, to replace that. They just look bad, and I don't know if there's a fix there on that side of the ball. And the offense, you know, is not working at full cylinder with some offensive linemen out for the year and whatnot. And so I don't know if they can keep up.
My stupid ass was calling them the most overrated team in the Big Ten before the season started, and yet did not think about the implications of that until midway through the game yesterday.
Well, just brag about the first part of that sentence, Ace.
Yeah, no, I felt good about the initial prediction, but everything else was not great.
Yeah, not great. Yeah.
So Minnesota had a 97.6% chance win probability in this game at one point.
I mean, they were up 17 in the fourth quarter or late third. So, yeah.
Yeah, this is like up 10 in the fourth quarter, and then, yeah.
I always think those win probability things are way off, because for all the, like, every weekend, it's like, oh, the Lions had a 99% chance to win that game, and then they didn't.
Yeah, but that's the Lions, Falcons, man.
The Falcons had a 99% chance to win that game, and it didn't. Minnesota had a 96. I mean, these comeback, like, they're way too confident.
When there's still a fourth quarter yet to be played, and it's only, you know, it's only like two scores or something, doesn't really mean much. But it's definitely always, I feel it's always impressive when you're looking at the Lions and the Falcons, because you know they're blowing those games spectacularly in the final minute or two.
Number 17, but Indiana at Rutgers. Indiana 37, Rutgers 21. Tell us all about it, Jamie. You had an okay weekend overall.
Yeah, not too bad. You know, talk to your kids about top 10 Indiana, right? after a slow start, and they were down 7-3 after the first quarter, we finally saw what we expect out of Michael Penix. He went 14 for 16 for 220 yards from the start of the second quarter till the middle of the fourth quarter. And it took a 7-3 deficit to a 37-15, pretty comfortable margin at that point. But other than that, that was really it for IU's offense. You know, they struggled running the football throughout the whole game against what seems to be a pretty fired up Rutgers defensive front. They won this game on defense, frankly. Rutgers really didn't do much on offense, and we don't give them a bunch of turnovers and start on the opposing side of the field, they're not going to score points.
Yeah, Rutgers accumulates under 250 yards of offense. Noah Vedral throws for 3.8 yards an attempt with three interceptions. That's a single-digit QBR. That's not good.
Rough.
Yeah.
Isaiah Pacheco goes 10 carries, 26 yards.
A
second running back did rip off a 37-yarder, but this is back to being Rutgers without seven turnovers to help them out, I guess.
Right, yeah. On their first nine drives of the game, they had 4 3-and-outs, they had 1 first down and a punt, they had a one-play interception drive, they had a three-play interception drive, then they had a first-down and interception drive. So, yeah, it was almost the exact opposite of the Avalanche that went in their favor a week ago against Michigan State. And we talked about Minnesota's yards per play against on defense. Indiana is trending in the opposite direction. They are fifth right now in the Big Ten, allowing only 4.7 yards per play. And I know they played Rutgers, but they've also played Penn State. Last year, they were almost at 6 yards per play against in Big Ten play. So looks like a pretty solid step forward for this defensive crew. We'll see if it holds up.
Purdue 31, Illinois 24. This is actually somewhat impressive from Illinois' perspective because their top two quarterbacks were out with COVID.
And a boatload of other players. Yeah.
Tracy, they were down 14 players. Thanks, Wisconsin. Corin Taylor, a sophomore, throws for almost 10 yards an attempt, does throw two picks. But their defense gets absolutely shredded by Aiden O'Connell, who goes for 371 yards, 10.6 yards an attempt.
Yeah.
29 of 35. And David Bell is, again, just the man.
Totally. Awesome game. 9 catches, 122 yards. He scored a touchdown, and he had the game-clinching 25-yard catch when Illinois was seemingly had all the momentum and were about ready to mount a comeback. Milton Wright chipped in 100 yards, so he's kind of emerging as a solid number two receiver. And Zach Horvath, again, another 100-yard game. He also added 55 yards in receiving, and he's the first Purdue Boilermaker running back to have three straight 100-yard games since Mike Allstott did it in 1995.
So I have a lot of Illinois Twitter.
You know, you mentioned that their first...
They have some long-standing fans who are worth following because they you know, they've been through it all and they know what's coming, and like their Absolutely. Feeling this entire game was like, when are we just gonna, like, they had so many things like go right for them after they thought they were gonna lose. They're already down by 2 scores and they're just waiting to go down by 3 scores, and like Illinois stays in it. And I don't know how much of that was luck or how much of that was like them pulling off great plays, but they did, like, you know, finish total yardage was in their favor in this game, and they actually had a chance to win a couple times.
Yeah, after they fell down 31-10, they put together a couple touchdown drives to cut it to 31-24, and then they got the ball again. They got all the way down to the Purdue 15, but then three straight incompletions and then a fourth down pass that ended up short of the sticks kind of ended that drive where they were going in, or they were going in to tie it. They had two quarterbacks out with COVID, but then their quarterback who actually started the game limped out of the game in the second quarter. So they were behind the eight ball on a lot of fronts at that position. Taylor played well, but he had two huge turnovers that made the game 31-10. He threw a terrible sidearm pass that gave the Boilers first down in the red zone. And then a couple drives later, he got hammered by the Purdue safety and fumbled, which was recovered in the end zone by Purdue. And that's how the game went from 17-10 to 31-10. Now, Illinois needed needed a turnover and a turnover on downs themselves to stop some Purdue drives that quarter. So maybe that evened out, but that's what made the game 31-10. You know, but from that point on, you know, Illinois kind of had Purdue they had Purdue on the run. They finally got Emmett Tibobe, or however you pronounce it, into the ball game a little bit. And
I know this one.
What I thought was
Hator Bebe.
They had two of them.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you.
That's right. They got the other Hator Bebe involved as well.
Both of them were making catches there on that on the comeback that fell short. What I thought was interesting was Purdue has kind of found a running attack with Horvath, but when they were trying to, you know, kill the clock there in the fourth quarter, they had three different drives and they just passed. They barely ran. And they ended up having to punt the ball away without taking too much time off the clock. And I think there were two reasons for that. One, Horvath had fumbled twice already during the game. But two, up until that point, and this is midway through the fourth quarter of game two, up until that point, Illinois' defense had only forced three incomplete passes all year. Then they forced four down the stretch, and they get the ball back, and they get their offense going, and they kind of almost pull off a miracle win. Instead, Purdue wins. They go up to 2-0, and now Jeff Brohm is 14-15 in Big Ten play, which is not the best record, but they only had 12 Big Ten wins in the previous 7 years before his arrival. And they look as good as anybody right now to win that division, especially given Wisconsin's issues. That's who they're supposed to play next, by the way.
Well, there's a freebie.
Well, I mean, they're not going to win the game.
Yeah, no, they're not.
So somehow Wisconsin's going to get away with not forfeiting these games that they should be forfeiting. Northwestern 21, Iowa 20. This one was not pretty. Spencer Petras threw 50 passes, acquires 216 yards, but that's 4.3 an attempt. Also throws three picks. Peyton Ramsey only throws 18 passes. They run it 16 times for 2.4 yards a carry.
60 times,
and I didn't pull out sacks, and there's two team rushes in there, but Bowser averaged 3.4 yards a carry, Ramsey averaged 2.2, Jesse Brown, the backup, 10 carries, 2.1 yards an attempt. Did Mick McCall sneak back into the stadium?
Right, totally. That Isaiah Bowser line is right out of the Justin Jackson handbook.
Yeah,
a lot of carries, not a lot of yards. Yeah, they had two drives in the first half. One went for 14 plays, one went for 16 plays, and all they were doing was running for like 3 yards and converting on, you know, third and threes. They'd get 4 yards, or maybe they'd only get two, and then they'd go for fourth and one and get it. It was definitely an ugly game. You know, we kind of tisked Iowa last week for going away from the running game. What do you consider this, 50 times with your quarterback in his second start? He kind of came out hot. He was 9 for 11 for 96 yards in the first quarter, but then he was only 17 for 39 for 120 yards the rest of the day. It was just a lot of nothing. They didn't really bring him down with sacks, but he just looked really uncomfortable the whole time. He was throwing it high a lot. In fact, he threw a huge interception in the fourth quarter that somehow was beyond the reach of Laporta, who is like 7 foot tall tight end, and it just landed in the Northwestern defensive back's hands. That was their best chance to retake the lead there at the end. And boy, I don't know which bad Iowa stat do you want. I've got a couple of them.
I'll give them all.
Okay, all right. Iowa has not scored a third quarter point in six straight Big Ten games. they have not scored a touchdown in the second half in five straight Big Ten games.
Oh man.
Yeah. And Kirk Ferentz is now 9-11 against Northwestern.
Ha!
He's 9-11 against Northwestern. You know what other coach had a losing record against Northwestern? Tom Crean.
Really?
So, yeah, Tom Crean had a losing record against Northwestern. I mean, he lost his first, like, seven against them when they were buried with sanctions and never really climbed out of that.
Oh, okay, yeah. That makes a lot more sense now.
Brady Hoke is undefeated against Northwestern.
Right. Well, I'm proud we are of all
How about that? Let's not talk about Michigan football coaches right now.
Yeah.
It still just baffles me that Tyler Goodson got 13 carries in this game. Now he only got 3.3 yards a carry. He wasn't really ripping him off. But
he looked decent.
Every time you turn on Iowa, you're like, that guy can play. And
yeah,
totally.
For some reason, Iowa, of all teams, just isn't feeding him the ball. This was an issue last week, too.
Kirk Ferentz must be rolling over in his grave.
Well, yeah, neither team had 300 yards offense. The yards per play was 4 for Iowa, 3.5 to Northwestern. There wasn't much going on here. You know, Iowa got out to a 14-0 lead because two Northwestern turnovers, including a muffed punt, really set them up, you know, basically in scoring position. Other than a field goal drive later in that half, that field goal drive was the only legitimate drive they had all game. And then in the second half, they had drives that started at their own 8, 13, and 18. So they just, you know, other than the two drives that Northwestern gifted them early, they had long fields and they couldn't travel them.
Finally, Ohio State 38, Penn State 25.
Good podcast, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Sean Clifford actually does a fairly stand-up job as a passer against Ohio State defense. But they can't run. They get one 23-yard run from Devin Ford, and they had 21 rushing yards the rest of the game. Now, there's 5 sacks of Clifford in there, but not a real – I mean, they only ran the ball with the running back 9 times. So,
right.
Will Levis is a quarterback, so
– Oh, 8 times.
8 times. Yeah, we didn't see Kevon Lee or Keziah Holmes in this game, and I know they're freshmen, and maybe the moment's too big for them. I don't know, but they both played in the second half in last week's game in a game where they were behind the whole time. So I was surprised that we didn't see them. Last week, Clifford ripped 119 rushing yards off against Indiana. You throw those sacks out, though, he still only had 33 yards on 13 carries. So that's a big part of their offense that was negated. And it sure did look like in the first half of this game that Penn State kind of centered their game plan around Clifford's legs, and it didn't go anywhere. The design quarterback draws and the scrambles were met with big fat Ohio State defenders that crunched him at the line of scrimmage in most cases. And you know, we talked about how IU kind of is vulnerable to that. You know, obviously Ohio State isn't. Clifford's numbers were great, but you know, most of those numbers though were built after they had gotten the 31-13 deficit. So I kind of take some of that with a grain of salt.
It's wild that having their least athletic skill position player be the guy to tote the rock the most didn't exactly work against Ohio State.
Yeah, right.
Ace really wants his podcast to be over.
I get it. Do we want to talk about James Franklin going forward on 4th-and-2 in his own territory on their first drive?
Do we? Like, they were on the 45. Like,
I thought that was the right call. You're not going to, like, you know, you're not going to win on defense against Ohio State. Like,
no. Take
your shot.
No. Yeah, I get it. I definitely did not like the play call, though. It was a screen pass that Ohio State sniffed out immediately. And one of the storylines in their loss to Indiana was every screen pass they tried was blown up. Taiwan Mullen, Indiana's DB, blew up 2, and then they blew up 1 screen pass so bad it forced one of those first half turnovers that Clifford did. So to me, to see them try that on 4th-and-2 was not good. Maybe any other play would have been nice. Maybe a pass to Freiermuth at the sticks. I don't know. But that screen pass was snuffed out, and it kind of gave me flashbacks to some of their bad execution the week before. That's kind of why I wanted to talk about it.
They also tackled the quarterback and the running back with one defensive lineman, which was like the most crucial moment of the game.
But right. Ohio State only went 1-for-3 on field goals.
So that's
weakness.
That's
weakness.
All right, Jamie.
Two of those field goals were extra point length. So.
All right, Jamie. Thanks for talking to us. We'll talk to you again next week if the world continues to exist. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening to the MGO podcast. I am Bay Sambender, along with Brian Cook and Seth Fisher. Stay tuned next week to see if plucky underdog Michigan can hang with ranked powerhouse Indiana. I was considering don't fire anybody yet as a hot take.
Damn it. That was mine.